Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to Why Wars Happened, a history podcast where we sit down with filmmakers and historians and we talk about war. Today's guest is Dr. Nick Lloyd, professor of modern warfare at King's College London. He is a best-selling author who has published multiple books, and they're all about military history. And he is the author of today's book, The Western Front. Nick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
I loved your book. I have to ask, though, my first question, that thing is a beast. Oh my God, there's so much in there. How freaking long did that take to write? I think it was like 20 hours of the audiobook.
It took sort of just over 3 years, really. But I mean, obviously, it's been a culmination of a life, a professional lifetime kind of studying the war, really. So even though it actually, you know, it's not like I've been writing the book for 10 years or anything like that. But obviously, the approaching something of this scale and size, you can only really do when you've kind of been around the field for so long that you really feel comfortable to do it. So the Western Front, and then, you know, the subsequent books that I'll have done and will do on the First World War, kind of a culminating moment in a lifetime of studying the war and a lifetime of fascination on the war. So yeah, it's got sort of, you know, I put everything into it. So, you know, hopefully readers can really understand that and feel confident that I know what I'm talking about with it.
Oh, definitely. It's so comprehensive. If you just, you know, what I find, it's kind of weird. I find it really relaxing. So at night before bed, I like to listen to these like history books. And this, it's 20 hours of the audiobook. I loved all of it. But I was just really impressed. Like, a lot of history books aren't that comprehensive. And I didn't find it overcomplicated either. I don't think that you just put a bunch of stuff that was like, what is he talking about? And there's a lot to cover. I thought that it would have taken even longer to write.
Yeah, no, I was on a beach in Greece when I had the kind of idea for the book. And I very quickly after I got home, I got in touch with my agent and the publisher and said, what about this? And they went for it. So it's, yeah, it comes up. I mean, I think the book is important for a number of reasons we'll get into, but I think one of the reasons why, you know, it is what it is because it's the sort of style of the writing and really trying to get into the characters. And I think one of the problems in military history is it can be very difficult to read. So you can get, lots of different units moving around. And this is very, very hard for people to understand what's going on. I mean, even if they have maps in front of them, it's very difficult to kind of work out what's going on. And so I think trying to get what I tried is very much based on the characters of the individuals, trying to understand their kind of individuals, because often they can be quite difficult to read. And so that was a really key part of the book, was bringing them to life. And there is movement of units and stuff around, that you do talk about different units,
sure.
But it's not, hopefully it doesn't overwhelm the reader and you can actually understand the kind of dynamics of what's going on. Really, that was the aim anyway.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was surprised about, where it wasn't overwhelming. There were a lot of parts that you covered, but it wasn't overwhelming. So World War I is what we're talking about here. Everybody had this idea that, I feel like a lot of historians kind of like mention it, but don't get into it a lot, where everybody had this idea, like, oh, this is going to be over super fast, like 40 days. Like, we have this genius plan. Germany had this genius plan to end the war in 40 days. Obviously, it didn't happen. Why did everybody think it would be such a quick war?
Well, I mean, there is, not everybody does. I mean, there are some sort of outliers who argue it was going to be longer. Lord Kitchener, who becomes a British Minister of War, Secretary of State for War, he is kind of one of the outliers who says it's lasted at least 3 years. But you are right. Most of the individuals, the key players involved, do think it will be a short, decisive, swift, bloody war. Now, that's certainly what the Germans are planning. The Schlieffen plan is about 6 weeks campaign in France, swift and decisive operations. And I think they do this for a variety of reasons, because a long war is not really what anyone wants to contemplate. They don't want it. Nobody wants it. Nobody can really can see actually how advanced societies can really survive in a lengthy war. Now, there's you know, there's very famous kind of before the war, you know, accounts and arguments that Norman Angell writes a book about this in 1913 about war between the powers, you know, major powers. It's simply impossible because of the nature of the modern economic system. Markets will collapse. So the whole thing of a long war is simply it cannot happen. And of course, everybody's wrong about that because it can happen. Right. I think what the war shows is just how enormously strong and resilient many of these economies actually are. They can actually keep going through months and months and years of the most terrible strain and stress. So I think there's a combination of factors. They think that, you know, look at something like the Russo-Japanese War a decade earlier. It had been, you know, it'd gone on for over a year, but, you know, the kind of side with the aggression and the ability to will to conquer had succeeded, and it was assumed that that would be the way again. So as long as you hit it hard in the opening months or the opening weeks, you could gain an advantage and you would be able to impose your will on an opponent, and then it would have to settle. Democracies were weak. Democracies were, you know, have to consult the people. And so therefore, there's no way you could sustain consent for a long war. So I think it makes a lot of sense in many ways. I think there are obviously some people who are more concerned. I think someone like Kitchener thinks it's going to be 3 years because he studied the American experience with the Civil War. No one thought the South would last for 4 years plus. But it's also because he's not, you know, he rates the German army, doesn't necessarily think that much of the French army. So, you know, he thinks that if the war is going to carry on, the French are going to need serious help. So, in some ways, you know, Britain can only win a long war. Germany can only really win a short war. They all have different strategies so they approach it, but it's very, very difficult to see, you know, what happens. I mean, the whole German plan, the whole operational strategic plan, as we call the Schlieffen plan, is based upon, you know, you can't have a long war because in a long war we'll be attacked on multiple different fronts on both sides, east and west. Therefore, we have to have a short war.
So it's a little bit of miscalculation, a little bit of optimism kind of gone wrong about the length of the war. Okay, let's hop into Belgium for a second. And for our listeners out there who might not know, Belgium is kind of a little country that's basically between Germany and France.
I'm sure the Belgians will be very pleased with that description.
It's a beautiful, beautiful country. But you know, just to simplify it, oversimplify it. But it was very important at the beginning of the war. And I kind of wanted to talk about that because you don't hear a lot about this part of World War One, where it was that whole conference where all these countries are coming together. And Belgium's like, we're just going to be neutral. We're not choosing sides. And Germany's like, please let us through. We want to attack France. And they're like, no. And so Germany's like, well, we're going to have to anyways then. We're going to force our way through. I kind of wanted to ask about you. You mentioned the German kind of representative there, Herr von Strom. And you're talking about him in this way where he's kind of tearful, almost crying, like, why don't the Belgians just let us through? Can you tell us a little bit more about that whole situation?
Well, I mean, I think it sums up a kind of a German arrogance and, you know, why won't you simply let us do what we want to do? Why are you so stupid that you're not going to let us sort of conquer Western Europe? Why can't you silly little country just get out of the way? And they feel that way with a lot of powers, including the British and the Americans. They think, why are you just let us do what we want to do? So there is a sort of German arrogance that he's shown, I think, but there's also a sense of, really? I mean, are you really going to stand against the German army? I mean, it's not going to be good for you if you do. So, but I think there's that sort of underestimation of nationalism and a desire of, you know, if something's not right, we're going to try and fight on. And so there is that sense of actually not understanding that. And you could say that many powers at the time make that same error. You know, the Austrians underestimate Serbian nationalism. They say the same thing to Serbia, just let us do what we want. Serbians say no.
And there were rumors that France wanted to go through. There's some debate on, did France actually want to go through Belgium too to get to Germany?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, there is huge, you know, huge sensitivity in this kind of July crisis about, because the French, they, well, actually, if we can get into Belgium first, we can set up good defensive positions. And Joffre, who's the French commander-in-chief, sort of trails this past the government? And they said, absolutely no, under no circumstance. You've got to be about 10 miles from the border. So you must be very, very clear away from the Franco-Belgian border. So there's no possibility of that. And so there are rumors that the Brits, you know, and in some ways, you know, what would have happened had the French actually violated Belgian neutrality first in August 1914? Would the British have come into alongside the Germans? I mean, that's a historical conundrum and a counterfactual for you. No one really assumes this is going to happen, but technically, whoever violates Belgian neutrality would have to get a warning from London. So, they're conscious of all of these sensitivities, and there are Belgian plans to attack the French at this point. So, you know, the British and the French have kind of talked to the Belgians about, you know, possible defense cooperation, coordination of plans, coordination of mobilization orders, railway timetables, supplies. But the Belgians are always very keen to say that, no, we cannot have any discussion of that. So, it is very, very sensitive. I mean, ultimately, the Germans would, you know, just sort of steamroll their way through with you know, the bulk of their army in that kind of northern half of the front.
So they invaded Belgium and then they occupied it. And that was its own long, long thing. Did they actually divert a lot of manpower and weaponry there that could have maybe changed some of the battle's outcome elsewhere if they hadn't been occupying Belgium?
It's difficult to say. I mean, there's a brigade that's garrisoning Brussels. There are troops that are, you know, obviously garrison Antwerp, or garrison parts along the coast. And so obviously they have to detach troops. But one of the problems Germans have is that it takes a while to get all their armies through Belgium. So, for example, when the German First Army hits the British Expeditionary Force at the Battle of Mons, late October 1914, it's a defensive victory, I suppose, if you call it that. The British sort of hold off the Germans for a day and then retreat. But at that point, the German First Army is absolutely massive. German First Army hasn't even fully deployed, so its rear echelon troops are still leaving their barracks in Germany when the front of the army hits the British. So you can imagine from Mons all the way through Belgium, across the Rhine into Germany, the First Army is kind of that whole thing. It's absolutely enormous. And so the problem is they've got a lot of troops, but they're not all at the front. They're kind of straggling around, because one of the things the Germans are very bad at in 1914 is, you know, they use railways to get their men to their jumping off points, and then they walk. And so they walk all the way, whereas the British, or the French, at least in this early phase, are actually very good at using strategic movement of railways and move all their troops up and down the front from rail. And whereas the Germans just don't really do this, they just walk. So the German troops were about 20 miles a day through August, every day, they're about 20 miles. They're absolutely shattered.
What?
By early September, they are on their knees.
That's crazy.
Yeah. All their equipment, they all their heavy bags, they just don't.
20 miles.
Yeah. Or I mean, sometimes they do a bit more, sometimes they do a bit less, but the march schedule of the German First and Second Armies is absolutely horrifying. And they are absolutely knackered. By the time they're there, they run into combat. They have to get into heavy combat. So, you know, the experience of those days is absolutely horrendous for the individual. You know, thousands drop out, and you know, from heat stroke and exhaustion. And as that goes on, they're just sort of dropping like flies, really.
It's crazy because, you know, obviously World War One was this huge turning point in warfare for what warfare is going to look like in the future. This massive, massive developments. I don't want to say progress, but developments. But you still hear, you have this one foot in the old world still, where you're just not, you don't have the railways and the transport systems. You got to march all this way. That's an interesting picture to think of.
Yeah, I mean, you do and you don't. You know, you have elements of modern world, but it's still very traditional in that respect. Certainly in 1914, I think when you get the trench deadlock, things change quite rapidly. And you have the kind of, so essentially, you know, what happens in those 4 years is those armies just become heavier and heavier. So they go from kind of essentially light forces all the way up to kind of, you know, very, very heavy firepower intensive formations. But you know, in that 4 years, the developments are enormous. And I chronicle this in the book. But I think in 1914, you do get a bit of, it's quite traditional. You know, you have horse-drawn artillery, you have cavalry, and you have infantry with a rifle and bayonet and not much else with a cloth cap. Or, you know, obviously the Germans have the Pickelhaube, but yeah, I mean, it's very traditional in that sense. You know, the British are in some ways are probably the most modern in a way, because their uniform is better at being camouflaged, basically, because that's how it was designed. And a lot of the equipment, like the webbing and the rifle, is designed for field use. It's designed to stand up to the rigors of combat. The French obviously go to war with the famously red trousers. That sort of phased out. Germans phase out their ceremonial helmets, and all that goes very, very quickly. So it's a mixture of modern and traditional, and the balance is not always quite right, because you have machine guns and things that are very, very powerful, but you have cavalry as well. Cavalry, as an aside, I mean, it's much misunderstood. I mean, cavalry is still quite useful in the First World War. They're not entirely, there are examples of British and German officers getting wounded by lances in 1914.
Lances?
Yeah, there's a handful that get wounded by lances, you know, actually in cavalry, cavalry charges, yeah. I mean, they're very rare, but it does happen, yeah. I mean, to get wounded by a lance, and majority of casualties are, of course, caused by, you know, artillery or machine gun fire, but there are a few that...
But a lance?
Yeah, there are a few that are hit actually by lances in cavalry actions with charges.
That's nuts. And, okay. I wanted to ask something. Wilhelm II, very, very well known for having a hand in pushing Germany towards war and wanting to militarize Germany, let's say, at the very least. But near the end of the war, maybe in the middle, he's kind of pushed aside into the shadows. And you go over this a little bit in your book, but I kind of wanted to ask, how did that happen? How do you have this guy who's the image of German militarization and now he has no power and he's in the shadows by the end of the war?
Yeah, I mean, he says famously in the war, he says, I don't direct the war, I just go for walks and chop wood. So, I mean, you know, you have the civilian, the political elite in Germany, which is weaker than, say, in France or Britain, where the political elite is all powerful, really. And you have the general staff who pull all the strings, really, particularly with sort of like the Stufenplanet organization. And as the war goes on, the military elite take more and more control of things like industry and war production. And so the power kind of moves into the military dictatorship, essentially. Now, coordinating the civilian political world and the military world should really have been the Kaiser's point, I suppose. But he doesn't really do that very well, and he struggles to control the military in the way he could. And... you know, he doesn't really feel able to take on the military. And when you have generals that have very strong personal followings and are very famous and well-loved, he doesn't really want to take them on. And so he finds himself struggling. I mean, he does intervene at key moments. He fires certain generals at key moments.
Okay.
He does still have that power, and he gives the go-ahead to certain policy decisions like unrestricted submarine warfare. Or, you know, he can intervene at key moments, but he can't kind of drag the nation together in a way that a Lloyd George or a Clemenceau would do from the Allies. He's weak in that sense, and of course, pathologically jealous of senior generals, aware that he
naturally that was his nature.
So I think, you know, he's a sort of tragic figure, really, I think, and his end is quite tragic in that sense. It's sort of, you know, he doesn't go out in a blaze of glory. He's just sort of roundly despised, really. Sort of seen as a kind of helpless
and a
figure.
Little putter,
and that sort of final days of him in October, November 1918 are quite painful to see, where people are just not interested in him anymore.
Did he just kind of not know the giant he awoke? Like, he's like, let's do this, let's militarize Germany, and then he's like, oh my god, I didn't know that this is what it was.
He's not solely responsible for it, of course, and I think, you know, that occasionally he does have insights. I mean, there's that sort of time in the July crisis where he said, well, why can't we just fight? Because the generals presented the Schlieffenplan saying, okay, well, if you're going to go to war against Russia to support of Austria, you need to invade France and Belgium, because this is the war plan. And he says, well, why can't we just fight Russia on our own? And then that causes Helmut von Moltke, who's the chief of the general staff, to almost have a nervous breakdown. And say, well, look, we spent 25 years doing all the movement schedules, the plan. That's the plan. That's what we do in a war. So ultimately, that causes the kind of crisis in the West. But in some ways, he had that right insight, which was actually, this is crazy. What are we doing? You know, why are we fighting here? We should do something different. But of course, he doesn't have the stomach and the control to actually say, no, you're not going to do this. We're going to do something else. So he has sort of an awareness, but of course, the longer the war goes on, the kind of weaker he becomes, really. And almost because of, you know, his physical deformity with his hand becomes a kind of right. symbol of a kind of broader deformity of Germany and also the kind of structure and system they have. But yeah, I mean, he's an interesting character, but ultimately, you know, the war is run by the generals and they're the people that ultimately lose the war.
So, okay, let's jump into the battles a little bit here. Everybody knows Battle of the Somme, Battle of Verdun, and Ypres, or Ypres, depending on how you pronounce it. Can you just really quickly tell us the reasons that the Battle of Verdun and the Battle of the Somme stick out to us so much?
These are the sort of the twin battles of 1916, the sort of middle year of the war. And I think they stick out because they're of the sheer horror and the enormity of the casualties and the horror in which those casualties cause, I think. They kind of epitomize modern total warfare, industrial slaughter, trench warfare. So I think Verdun is a kind of, it's a smaller battlefield than the Somme. The Somme is a bigger place. Verdun is much more constrained. And that's the sort of, you know, the sacrifice of the French to save, you know, their line and this kind of symbol of French prowess and French resistance. So Verdun becomes the kind of anvil upon French kind of resistance in the war and a great symbol of that. So that's why I think Verdun is remembered. The Somme is obviously predominantly a British battle. French do play a role in it, but it's been largely forgotten. But certainly for Britain, the Somme is the biggest battle we'd ever fought, and it's our first sort of introduction to modern industrialized total warfare. And certainly the Somme has a long and painful history in Britain, and it's a word, we can just say the word, and we have an image of futile slaughter and mud. So the Somme, certainly in Britain, is a kind of, it's a word that immediately has connotations of suffering and futility. And so for Britain, the Somme is a sort of, there's a before and after. There's the sort of innocence before the Somme and then the sort of no innocence after the Somme. Our innocence was destroyed after the Somme. Certainly the first day, the worst day in the history of the British Army. You know, famously, the sort of long lines of infantry going over the top. And so the Somme becomes in Britain the great kind of tragedy and a feeling that pretty much everything that happened after that was bad and you could sort of trace it back to it. So it has a real poignancy and power in Britain that really no other battle has.
There's this kind of idea that, you know, I've talked about this on the show before, where World War One was this, the end of the Edwardian era, the end of long summers and garden parties, and it kind of had this change on the home front where it felt like before the war and after the war, the world has totally changed. And then the Somme itself in the war felt like the same thing in the war, where it's like nothing was the same after that. Everything was totally different. And was that the battle where both sides started to realize this war is going to go on forever, indefinitely, or it's not going to be a very quick war, at least?
I think by 1916, I think there is a sense that short war illusion has gone. I think it really goes at the back end of 1915 is when the sort of that this is a sense, certainly the French and the British, that there is no way out of here. And the sort of French commander Petain basically writes a note in the sort of November of 1915, basically saying, you know, we've got to do something very different if we're going to win this. We're going to require different tactics. And the French admit to their allies, they say, well, you know, we've attacked repeatedly through 1915 and we failed. So basically it's over to you now. So the French are already failing in, by the end of 1915. They're kind of recognizing they don't know how to get out of the war. I think there's still optimism in Britain that the Somme is going to be the big push and things will be better. By October, November, that's kind of gone really.
Sure.
And I think, you know, that you get that period, that sort of late 1916, early, the winter of 1617 is probably one of the worst periods for the Allies because they are essentially running out of money, running out of people, and there's no end in sight. And so that period is a moment of great tension and gravity. Fortunately, the Germans save the situation by doing something of such radical stupidity with the unrestricted submarine warfare declaration, which is so dramatically bad that, you know, within a matter of months, the Americans have come in. And once the Americans come in, the light shines, you know. The Americans, it has that real shift of actually, we think we can win this now. Once the Americans come in, that is a transformative moment. Even though the Americans haven't set foot in France, the fact that they're in is a huge thing. But that period, late 16, early 17, is really where, you know, it's a really dark moment for the Entente.
There's this idea that the Germans kind of underestimated the Americans. And before America entered the war, there wasn't this idea like, oh, the Americans are going to be great and they're going to change everything. The Germans kind of disregarded it a little bit.
And certainly the German high command team really don't think too much about it, which is seems incredible. So they're warned that what happens if the Americans come in, and they think, well, we can win the war before they do, and then they don't have an army. And I mean, again, it's an incredible thing. I mean, Britain didn't really have an army in 1914, but it had one 18 months later. So again, given America's power and strength and population size, the idea that America couldn't do this, couldn't create an army if it so desired, seems, you know, flatly wrong. So I think there's obviously this sort of old world arrogance. I've seen sources where they, you know, they refer to the Americans as sort of cowboys. This derogatory language that you would have, it's sort of, you know, disdain for them. You know, they're financiers. Yeah. They're shop salesmen. They don't know how to fight in the way that Prussians do. Okay. But I think there is that real ignorance about American technological power and industrial power. And again, it seems incredible, but they absolutely do. And even when Americans sort of, you know, get into the field, they still kind of dismissive of them. But it's really the end of 1917 where Germany decides to attack again in the West that the true significance of the Americans is beginning to be felt, because they recognize, oh, maybe this isn't a good idea, and maybe the Americans are actually going to tip the balance, and therefore we should win before they can do that. So it's astonishingly short-sighted. And I think I've reflected on this in my multiple books multiple times, how the Germans don't win the First World War. It's quite incredible, because, you know, at so many points, they can walk off the battlefield with all their chess pieces intact, and they can exit the casino, they can exit and win, and they say, well, actually, we're just going to try one more time. Let's go to the blackjack table for one more time. And of course, they just get it wrong, and then they lose the house, you know. So it's incredible, but
that's a perfect way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, they do this all the time. And, you know, and I think one of the problems is, and you see this with the command team, with the German command team, is they have this absolute disdain for civilians, absolute disdain for particularly politicians. They will not listen to them. They absolutely despise them. And this is one of the problems with Ludendorff, who's the chief sort of German strategist, is he can only really envisage victory in terms of the kind of an enemy prostrate on the battlefield, you know, an enemy, you know, bowing to him, completely defeated on the battlefield. And when he is repeatedly told by the politicians, or even some of his own generals, look, you know, this is such a big war. There's going to have to be compromises here. We're going to have to do something about the state of Belgium. The Allies are fighting for Belgium. If we could give them something, we've got to give them something to stop fighting. He's not interested. He said, well, the way is we win on the battlefield. And they're trying to tell him, look, is that likely to happen? Are you going to be able to do this? And that's that, you know, for Ludendorff, it's a total victory or nothing, or total defeat. And in the end, it's like he's going to bet the house black or red kind of thing. Well, we're going to do it because the alternative is compromising with the grimy politicians. And I don't want to do that. I want victory, and I want total victory. And so it's a mindset that is not interested in any compromises whatsoever, which is ultimately devastatingly ineffective. Whereas, you know, if you have an alternative scenario where in 1918, the Germans defeat Russia in the East, bring all their men to the West, dig in further and say, perhaps we can go back to 1914 borders. Perhaps we can give up Belgium, maybe some economic ties. We can win in the East. We could have a sort of score draw in the West.
They want everything.
Very difficult for the Allies to continue fighting if that is a genuine thing. Now, it would be politically costly to the Germans, but they would get out with, you know, essentially an entirely new empire in Central and Eastern Europe.
And two would never have happened.
It would be a totally different scenario, but they decide, actually, you know what, we've got a window of opportunity, so we're going to go for full total victory, which I think was you know, highly risky and doesn't work out. But it's just the Western Front is a story that it's like it comes full circle. You know, they try to win 1914, it doesn't work. And then everything happens. And then 1918, they get an opportunity to try it again. And it doesn't work again for various reasons. But there's that feeling of kind of things coming full circle at the end of the war. And so you get that kind of symmetry with the history of the Western Front, which is really interesting.
So, you know, we're talking about this kind of arrogance that the German military had. And that brings me to my next point of gases and chemical warfare. It had already been outlawed. And Germany had... already before the war had already agreed to not use chemical warfare. But during the war, they're like, yeah, we don't care. International repercussions. Why didn't they care that they were breaking this agreement?
Well, I mean, there's a sense that it's actually used as a kind of diversion. So they decide to use it in the West to divert the movement of German units to the East for a local offensive in the East. So that there's a sort of almost taken as a secondhand decision. And I think this epitomizes the problem of German decision-making, which is a decision which is inherently a massive political one with huge ramifications for the image of Germany, the horrors of Prussian barbarism and all this kind of stuff. It's basically taken by military commanders with very little civilian input. The same as the whole Schlieffen Plan. Well, we're going to have to invade France and Belgium. The only problem really is a technical, operational, military problem. How do we get railways to work? Where divisions can move? That's the problem, rather than you're actually violating the sovereignty of a sovereign state, which is going to have massive international repercussions. It might bring the British on board, you know, into the war. That needs to be discussed at a high level with your entire cabinet. But it's effectively these massive decisions are relegated essentially to a military technical problem. Again, submarine warfare, potentially bringing in the greatest power in the world, is a technical problem. Well, we just need to work out how many submarines or U-boats we have. Can they do the job? Well, probably. Well, that's the decision taken. Will it help us militarily? We think it will. Therefore, we'll take the decision. Well, this has massive ramifications at political level that need to be discussed, and they're simply not. And so the gas is another one of those kind of decisions, which is taken at a military technical, almost a tactical level to, well, actually, this is, you know, we have a big chemical industry. We're running out of shells. Actually, this is quite useful on the battlefield. We think we're going to try it. So again, you get this, they use it, and then it makes the First World War slightly nastier than it otherwise would have been. But it is a unique thing that all had, and the experience was sufficiently horrible that all the sides in the Second World War don't go anywhere near it, despite doing everything else.
So the Battle of Ypres is the first time that chemical warfare was used, and it was used by the Germans. And is that why you say that that battle was uniquely depressing?
Well, I mean, there's four battles of Ypres, and they get more depressing as they go forward. The third battle, Passchendaele, is probably the most depressed, most awful condition. The start of chemical warfare is the start of where it's used, and you see the development of chemical warfare during the war. So they start it very crudely and basically filling very common chlorine in big gas cylinders and big, huge, very heavy cylinders. They basically hook them up to rubber tubes, hoses, and then throw them into no man's land, open the sort of valves, and then sort of let the wind do it. It's very crude. It's not particularly effective, particularly as the prevailing wind in most of the north of France is the other way. So it would actually naturally favor the Allies. But then rapidly, they try different uses of what we call cloud gas. But it's always messy. It never really works. You're always at the mercy of the weather. And even if the Germans wait until they get ideal weather to use it, but that's not a particularly ideal scenario. Until rapidly, both sides recognize that actually it's better to use it in a different kind of way. And so the British develop things like phosgene. It's used to fire enemy gun batteries so that the people manning the gun batteries will have to wear masks. It will be horrible to do, and they'll actually won't be able to fire their artillery back. And the British use this quite a lot. So they'll blanket German gun batteries with gas to make them ineffective. the Germans encounter with probably the worst gas of all, which is mustard gas, which is bad because it has a, if it touches the skin, it burns, and it can lie in the ground for weeks on end. And then when sunshine goes on it, it kind of reforms. It sort of turns into gas again. And then, so mustard gas is a very good defensive weapon. You could fire it into an area and then you make it basically too toxic for anyone to go in. So it's designed to create casualties. So you walk through an area and then within an hour, everybody's retching, everybody's got burns on their hands. And so the British develop, the British also develop it, but it's not that, because if you were advancing, you don't want to fire a load of mustard gas and then have to go through it.
Oh, no.
And then you have things like what they call mask breakers. So the masks get better as the war goes on, although something like mustard gas is going to hurt you, it's not necessarily that toxic to breathe, but it's horrible, very, very horrible. But you do get lots of the gases that are more initially lethal. And so the Germans try a thing what they call the mass breakers, essentially kind of like laughing gas, where they'll fire it in. And then if you get any of this stuff under your mask, you can't put your mask on. And then they'll fire more toxic gases in to obviously either kill or wound you. So you don't know which gases they're using. And so they chloropicin, I think, is a mass breaker, they call it. It's horrific. They use one of the other things I found by reading the Canadian historian Tim Cook, is the amount of gas that's used increases exponentially in the last year of the war, firing stuff all the time. So it is a very horrible experience, and it causes significant numbers of casualties. Now, people argue, is it worse dying from gas than having your limbs blown off from a high explosive shell? But it is certainly that if you look at the memoirs and the diaries, gas becomes really horrible. A really horrible experience, and you're never free of it. You always have to have that gas mask ready, and you're ready to go with it, because it sort of adds a kind of layer of stress to the experience of the Western Front that you don't have on other theaters of war, and you don't have in subsequent wars or previous wars. So gas is one of those things which really gives the Western Front part of its reputation for horror, I think.
Yeah, and you can go on YouTube right now and watch videos of, it's kind of these like training videos where men were all lined up and then someone would give a command and they'd all see how fast they could get their gas masks on. And it was like part of everyday training. And we talk about this in another episode on World War One, where the mustard gas is really an oil. It's like a mist oil spray. And I think of it every time I make breakfast, I spray, you know, the olive oil or the, and it's like that stuff really does get everywhere and it's really hard to clean. And imagining that is something that burns your arms away or your face away.
It's really horrible. Yeah. Sort of, there's nothing. I mean, it's an indication, I think, of just how everything is tried. You know, and this is a war that's so technological by the end of the war. And I mean, if you just think of the amount of industrial production and development of science and technology that you have to do to create these gases, store them, transport them to the front, deploy them, as well as the research and development on gas mask. It's absolutely phenomenal that goes into it, because these things just can't be created, considering that in 1914, the biggest chemical industry in the world is in Germany. So when Britain has a big chemical industry by 1918, that's almost entirely created ad hoc during the war. It's a really stunning kind of industrial transformation. Again, Britain has one of the largest air forces in the world by 1918. That's entirely created during the war. Britain's producing a million shells, every few days. Entirely kind of created the war. So you have kind of almost a second industrial revolution during the war. And again, one of the things about the Western Front to bear in mind is how quick it was. Somebody was told me, I'm not sure if this is true. I think it is true, but somebody was saying that the people who went ashore on D-Day in 1944 had been training for that for longer than the First World War had taken place. They're training for it for over 4 years, you know, 1940 to 1944. Whereas you think Britain comes into war in August, so it's quite late into 1914, and within 18 months is actually... So in the British Staff College before the war, they had sort of blue sky thinking sessions before the war about potentially what we might do. And the largest deployment we would ever consider, theoretically or in a fantastic scenario, was 6 divisions. Of troops. Within 18 months of the start of the war, we've actually got about 60 divisions. So within, a very short period of time, we've gone from 6 divisions to 60. We had most of the original expeditionary force who go to France in August, are either dead or wounded. We've developed armored warfare. We've developed aerial warfare. We're deploying gas. We've created steel helmets. And so you can see within 18 months, it's absolutely phenomenal. And so this is why the reputation of the Western Front is this period, this sort of place of static and of kind of futility and sane tactics is actually incredibly wrong. It's a period of probably the most innovation and change sort of in the military in any period in modern history. There's no other period in modern history where it changes so much. Arguably, maybe the creation of the atomic bomb changes things, I suppose. Discount that, there's no other period which has seen such change as the period between late 1914 and, say, early 1917. It's just a period of, I mean, they're creating all this stuff in an ad hoc way. So again, you know, Britain creates the first tank from a standing start within just over a year.
It was like what Leonardo da Vinci 600 years ago had these drawings of a possible tank, and then now World War One comes, and then all of a sudden we're like, oh, we're just going to build that. We're going to use it. And you have all this development in World War One, and then in World War Two you have further development, and then you have the atomic bomb. And so there's this famous Einstein quote where he says, I don't know what weapons World War III is going to be fought with, but I know that World War IV is going to be fought with sticks and stones. Kind of like this, what's the end point to all of this escalation? But that also reminds me of a question. World War I was thought of as the war to end all wars, the Great War. Did people really believe that once this is over, we're not going to do this again because it's nuts?
Well, I mean, there's a certain liberal class in Britain that wants to believe this and does believe that, I think Wilson calls it making a world safe for democracy. So I think this is because the war had been so terrible, then there must be what's it all for? And so it has to be the end of war. That's a logical idea. But again, you go outside the salons of, you know, Washington and London, and there's no real idea that there's the end of war. So you look at the defeated powers, you know, you look at Germany, there will be another war. They want another war. France fears another war. Russia is already fighting its next war in the Russian Civil War. Italy is planning another war of imperial conquest, and so on and so forth. Turkey is in another war. You know, Ottoman Empire has collapsed and it's going to fight the Greeks and sort of control Anatolia. So you might be in sort of London, you think we can create League of Nations, but actually most of Europe, the ruins of the empires. There's no sense that war is over. War continues. In what the new states of Poland and Hungary and Romania, war continues. War carries on. Almost without skipping a beat. And that's one of the things when I talk about the Eastern Front, the sort of second volume of the book is. Whereas in the Western Front on the 11th of November at 11 o'clock, 1918, you know, the war ends. The guns stop firing. The birds start to sing. There is that real clear end to the war. But almost nowhere else do you get that. You don't get it in the East. You don't get it anywhere else. So fighting just continues, but it changes. The war mutates. You know, from Britain's perspective, we've won the war. We've expanded the empire. It's been terribly costly. This better be the last war because we can't afford another one. And we won. But if you're a defeated power like Germany, no, there will be another war. And this time we will win it. That's the idea. That's the goal. So that their problem is working out how to do it better. And so very early on, the Germans are trying to work out, okay, well, what went wrong? What do we need to do? Can we use things like tanks? So there's a very different conversation happening than there. So it's a dream and an illusion, of course. And it's an illusion that is with us today. You know, war had not been seen in Europe for decades. And that's why I think politicians and that were so shocked when Putin sort of invaded in Ukraine in 2022, because, well, war was finished,
like,
right?
We thought war was over.
War was over. Well, actually, no. So, yeah, I think there is that sort of illusion, and they desperately want it to be. And there's the idea that they can kind of solve all the problems, and then everything will kind of be very, very, you know, sort of safe.
I feel like World War One, the war to end all wars, reminds me of Caesar conquering Gaul. I wonder if they thought the same thing back then, like, dude, war's over now. We did it.
Well, for the victor, this is what you want. You want status quo, right? This is it now. It's like, you know, for Britain, we really needed history to end in about 1900. You know, history ends when we have the largest empire in the world, and that's it. So that's fine, guys. History is over now. We've decided everything. We just hope, you know, we've managed to get the seat at the end of the, you know, at the end of the disco. We're fine. The music stopped. We've got all the chairs. But actually, history's not like that. It moves on and moves on, you know. And so,
yeah,
that's just the logic of history and everything. So, you know, any kind of understanding for that. If you lose a war, then that's a very different experience and a very different scenario. And the question is, when can I get back on top? When can I get my opportunity? So many victors assume that the war is settled. There's one of my favorite quotes from Karl von Clausewitz, that famous theorist, where he says, in war, the result is never final. And he reminds us that, you know, as soon as you win, your opponent or what's left of them will start trying to work out a way to defeat you. And that's just the truism. It just will always happen. Happened to the Taliban when we threw them out in 2002. You know, the war result is never final.
Yeah.
They, you know, bided their time. Built their strength up, as all guerrilla forces do. And it's rare that, you know, you can have that kind of enduring victory. So, yeah, the First World War is just one of those examples where all the illusions of an entire elite, I suppose, or an entire society, I think, are just destroyed. And the long trauma of the 20th century is because of that, really, including the Second World War and everything else.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be wars until there are no people left. So Nick Lloyd, author of The Western Front, that's what we're talking about today. There's lots of other cool stuff we didn't go over. I mean, I say cool stuff. There's horrible stuff in there, too, about different gases and different horrors of war. And you also have a book out on the Eastern Front, and you're doing another one. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So the third one will come out in 2027, and that will be a trilogy. So a full history of the First War in all its different guises, really. The second volume, The Eastern Front, came out earlier this year and obviously tells the sort of other side of the war that I hint at and I occasionally talk a little bit about in The Western Front, but you do go and see the all those other parts of the war in the East, Austria's war, the Russian Revolution, the war in the Balkans.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and answering all these questions. And I hope it's not too late over there in London.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye.